Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're doing something really targeted. Think of this as your ultimate prep session for that big monetary economics exam, focusing specifically on the advanced Keynesian perspective.
That's right. We're zeroing in on how central banks use interest rates as their main tool.
And specifically, how that works when prices and wages aren't perfectly flexible.
Exactly. We're skipping the absolute basics, you know, what money is, M1, M2, that stuff. We're jumping straight into the deep end.
Okay, so what's the mission then?
It's all about understanding why monetary policy has real teeth in the short run, why it affects output and jobs, not just prices immediately, and crucially, why that power fades over time.
And the core concept connecting all of this, the linchpin, is what economists call nominal rigidities, sticky prices, sticky wages.
Precisely. That assumption is the big departure point from the classical view where everything adjusts instantly.
So today, we'll explore why things are sticky, how that stickiness lets policy work, look at the models, especially the new Keynesian-Phillips curve, and tackle that huge debate. Should policy follow strict rules or have flexibility?
We'll be drawing on some foundational ideas here. Think Taylor, Calvo, Barrow-Gordon, the heavy hitters.
Got it. So classical world, double the money, prices double instantly, nothing real changes. Money's neutral.
Right, immediately neutral.
But introduce sticky prices.
And suddenly, when the central bank moves the nominal interest rate, the one it controls, the real interest rate, moves too. At least for a while.
Because prices haven't caught up yet.
Exactly. And that temporary gap, that window, that's where monetary policy does its work on the real economy. So we really need to dig into why that stickiness exists.
Okay, let's start right there then. The foundation. Why are prices and wages sticky? It seems intuitive, maybe, but why doesn't a rational firm just adjust prices constantly, especially compared to financial markets where things change second by second?
It's a great question. It really boils down to differences in market structure and just convention, really. The assumption that goods prices and wages, too, have inertia is kind of the bedrock institutional feature that makes these Keynesian-style models relevant in the short run.
So it's the difference in adjustment speed, fast finance, slow goods, and labor.
That's the technical lever, yes.
Yeah.
That mismatch is why a policy change that's purely nominal, like changing the money supply or the target rate, actually causes a real ripple effect through the economy.
But sticking with the firm's perspective, if inflation ticks up and my price is fixed, my real margin gets squeezed. Why would I, as a rational business owner, tolerate that? Why not just index my prices or change them more often?
Right. And that's where we need some micro-level explanations. The first one usually mentioned, maybe the most famous but also quite debated, is menu costs.
Literally the cost of printing new menus.
Yeah, that's the classic example. Or, you know, the broader administrative hassle, updating price tags, changing website listings, informing salespeople, renegotiating supplier contracts, maybe. There's a fixed cost to making a price change.
So to avoid those constant little costs, firms just set a price for a longer period, maybe write a multi-period contract.
That's the argument. Minimize those transaction costs. But, and this is a big but, the new classical critique comes in strong here.
Okay, what's the critique?
The question is, why are these costs only about changing the nominal number? If inflation is happening, why not just write a contract that says my price is X, indexed to the CPI, and still only change the base price infrequently?
Ah, so relying purely on menu costs kind of assumes firms aren't thinking in real terms. It smells a bit like money illusion.
Exactly. Critics argue it assumes firms, or maybe their customers, are weirdly focused on the nominal number, not the real value. If the menu costs are tiny compared to overall revenue, it seems like a weak explanation on its own for significant economy-wide stickiness.
So the benefit of keeping the price fixed must somehow outweigh the cost of having the wrong real price for a while.
Precisely. And this pushes us towards explanations that are often seen as, well, maybe more robust. We need to think about different types of markets.
Okay.
You have your auction markets, the commodities, stocks where prices move constantly to clear the market. But most of the economy doesn't work like that. It works in what are called customer markets.
Like ordering from a catalog or getting a price for a car repair.
Exactly. Those prices are often preset, sometimes for months or even years. Think about the efficiency gain there.
Efficiency? How so?
Well, imagine if the price of everything had to be renegotiated on the spot based on aggregate demand conditions every single time you bought something.
Yeah.
Coffee, plumbing, software licenses.
Chaos. Massive time costs.
Huge search and bargaining costs. Presetting nominal prices makes transactions incredibly efficient. You know the price, I know the price. We can trade quickly, anywhere, anytime. That aggregate efficiency gain gives firms a strong, rational reason to keep nominal prices fixed for a while, even if it means their real price isn't perfectly optimal after some unexpected macroeconomic shock.
That makes intuitive sense. And there's a competitive angle too, right?
Yes, the coordination game aspect. Firms watch their rivals. If I think my competitors are not going to raise their prices after, say, a cost increase, I'll be very hesitant to be the first mover.
Because you'd lose market share.
Right. Or if I cut prices when others don't, I might just lose margin unnecessarily. So firms often fall into these implicit conventions about how to interpret demand signals or when it's acceptable to change prices. It reduces competitive uncertainty.
But those conventions might not be the best way to handle a big economy-wide shock.
Exactly. They're good for managing local competition, but they can create aggregate inertia when faced with something like a major monetary policy shift.
And you mentioned this isn't set in stone. The degree of stickiness can change.
Oh, absolutely. It's not a universal constant. History shows huge variation. You see more price flexibility during really turbulent times like the U.S. during World War I's high inflation, or maybe the U.K. in certain post-war periods.
And less flexibility at other times.
Definitely. Think about the post-World War II U.S. economy. A key feature then was the rise of long-term, often three-year, staggered wage contracts, especially in unionized sectors.
Staggered meaning not everyone's contract renews at the same time.
Exactly. Some renew in January, some in July, etc. When you institutionalize wage stickiness like that, it automatically builds inertia into the system. It gives stabilization policy a much longer lever, a longer window where it can have real effects.
So understanding the institutional context, contract lengths, market structures is critical for gauging how long that short run might actually last. Could be 3 years, could be much longer.
Precisely. It depends on the era and the economy.
Okay, let's move to the policy effects then. We accept rigidities exist. How does the central bank actually use this friction? And the crucial part, how temporary is this power?
Right. The short-run mechanism is pretty direct. If the central bank manages to lower the nominal interest rate, say, by buying bonds and increasing the money supply, and crucially, if prices and expectations about future prices are sticky,
then the nominal rate cut becomes a real rate cut.
Almost one for one, initially. Because the price level part of the real rate calculation hasn't adjusted yet. That lower real interest rate is what stimulates borrowing and spending, investment, consumption, the usual suspects.
Okay, let's walk through a surprise. Say the Fed unexpectedly pumps money into the system.
Okay, unexpected monetary expansion. Because prices are sticky in the immediate term, the real money supply goes up. People and firms have more real purchasing power than they expected.
Which boosts demand.
Aggregate demand rises. Firms see this increased demand. Since their selling prices are fixed for now, they respond by, well, first running down inventories, but then by increasing production to meet the demand.
So output goes up, maybe unemployment falls below its natural rate temporarily.
Exactly. You get a short-run boomlet driven purely by the monetary surprise interacting with the price stickiness.
And the empirical evidence backs this up, that the empirical impact is on output.
Largely, yes. Things like VAR studies vector autoregressions. They generally show that after a monetary policy shock, output and employment respond relatively quickly, while inflation responds with a significant lag, maybe several quarters later. That lag is the short run where policy has real effects.
Okay, that's the short run, the Keynesian playground. But eventually, the classical world comes knocking.
Inevitably. Over the longer haul, think years, decades, the quantity theory of money tends to reassert itself. As those sticky prices and wages gradually get renegotiated, as contracts expire, as menus get reprinted,
they adjust upwards to reflect the higher money supply.
Fully. Once all nominal variables have adjusted proportionally to the change in money, the real variables, output, employment, real wages, the real interest rate return to their long-run equilibrium levels, levels determined by fundamental factors like technology, capital stock, population growth.
And money becomes neutral again.
Completely neutral in the long run. Changing the amount of nominal money ultimately only changes the price level, not the real structure of the economy.
And the formal picture of this is the vertical long-run Phillips curve, right? No permanent trade-off between inflation and unemployment.
Exactly. Trying to keep unemployment permanently below the natural rate just leads to ever-accelerating inflation, not sustainable higher output. So the crucial takeaway for, you know, thinking about policy or exams is that the mechanism relies on short-run non-neutrality due to stickiness, but the ultimate destination is long-run neutrality.
Got it. This transition naturally brings us to the Phillips curve itself. It's really the story of how economists' understanding of that short-run trade-off evolved. Can we trace that journey?
Absolutely. The original Phillips curve, back in the 50s and 60s, was purely empirical. A simple observation, initially for the UK, of a seemingly stable, downward-sloping relationship between wage inflation and unemployment.
Lower unemployment seemed correlated with higher inflation.
Exactly. And policymakers initially thought, great, we have a menu of choices. We can accept a bit more inflation to get permanently lower unemployment, or vice versa, operate along the curve.
But that interpretation relied heavily on, well, on people being fooled, right?
Yes.
On money illusions sticking around.
Pretty much, yeah. The implicit microstory was something like, the government boosts demand, prices rise. Firms offer higher nominal wages to attract workers. Workers see the higher nominal wage, think they're better off in real terms, even if prices rose just as much, and supply more labor.
Unemployment falls.
But that only works as long as workers don't realize the price level also went up.
Precisely. It relies on them misinterpreting nominal changes as real changes. And that's unlikely to last forever if inflation becomes persistent.
Because rational people eventually figure it out. They do. And this realization, formalized by Milton Friedman and Edmund Phelps in the late 60s, led to the expectations augmented Phillips curve, EAPC.
Okay, what does expectations augmented mean here?
It means the short-run trade-off doesn't just depend on current unemployment. It also depends on what people expect inflation to be. Once workers and firms realize the general price level's rising consistently, they build that expectation into their wage demands and price setting.
So if everyone expects 3% inflation, they'll build that into contracts before any demand boost happens.
Exactly. And what does that do? It shifts the entire short-run Phillips curve upwards. Now, to get unemployment below the natural rate, you don't just need some inflation. You need inflation above what people were expecting. You need surprise inflation again.
So trying to keep unemployment permanently low requires constantly accelerating inflation, pushing the curve higher and higher.
Yes. If the central bank tries to peg unemployment below the natural rate, they have to keep surprising people on the upside. This generates an ever-increasing rate of inflation, a wage price spiral. It's unsustainable.
Leading to hyperinflation, potentially.
Potentially, yes. The inescapable conclusion from the EAPC is that the only sustainable long-run equilibrium is where unemployment is at its natural rate.
Per.
Any inflation rate is possible in the long run, but it won't buy you lower unemployment. The long-run Phillips curve is vertical at U.
So the apparent trade-off is only ever temporary, existing only as long as expectations lag behind reality or are temporarily fixed.
Correct. Any downward sloping curve you observe is just a short-run snapshot, specific to a particular level of expected inflation.
Okay, the EAPC was a huge theoretical leap, killing the idea of a permanent trade-off. But it often relied on backward-looking, maybe adaptive expectations, people forming expectations based on past inflation. What came next? How did we get to the modern view?
Right. The next big step was incorporating rational expectations, the idea that people use all available information, including knowledge of how the economy works and how policymakers are likely to behave, to form their expectations about the future. This led to the new Keynesian NK model.
So keeping the sticky prices, but assuming people are smart and forward-looking, that sounds like a tricky combination.
It is. The challenge was, how do you get short-run monetary non-neutrality if people anticipate policy perfectly? The answer came from building models with more explicit microfoundations for price stickiness.
Grounding the aggregate equations in the actual optimizing decisions of households and firms.
Exactly. Instead of just assuming a Phillips curve relationship, the NK approach derives it from models where individual firms face constraints on price adjustments. Two main types of models became standard.
Which are?
The Calvo pricing model, where firms get a random opportunity to change their price in any given period, and the Rotenberg pricing model, where firms can change their prices anytime but face a quadratic cost for doing so. Bigger changes are disproportionately more costly.
Let's focus on the Calvo intuition. If I'm a firm and I get my rare chance to set a new price today, but I know it might be stuck there for, say, the next year or two, What do I base that price on?
You have to base it not just on today's conditions, but on your best guess of what costs and demand conditions, and crucially, what overall inflation will be over the entire expected duration that your price will be fixed.
So I'm inherently forward-looking when I set my price.
You have to be. And when you aggregate that behavior across all firms in the economy, you get the new Keynesian Phillips curve, NKPC. The standard form looks like this. Lambda X plus beta plus 1 plus U dollar.
Okay, let's break that down. Hair-beller is current inflation.
Right. $6 is the output gap, how far output is from its potential or natural rate. That captures real economic pressure, essentially marginal costs.
FIT PT plus one is the crucial term.
That's the key innovation. It's the expectation form today of next period's inflation. Notice, current inflation depends on expected future inflation, not past inflation like in simple EAPC models.
And beta.
That's the discount factor, usually close to one. It reflects that firms care slightly less about the distant future than the near future, and Everbellers is a cost-push shock, like an oil price spike.
Wow. So current inflation depends directly on where people think inflation is going. Policy becomes all about managing expectations.
Absolutely central. The central bank's job within this framework is usually modeled as minimizing a loss function, trying to keep both inflation and the output gap close to their targets, usually zero for both.
Okay, how does the central bank do that, facing this forward-looking curve? How should it react to different shocks? Let's say there's a sudden boom in consumer confidence, a positive demand shock shifting the IS curve out.
In that case, the optimal policy is clear. Offset the shock completely. If demand pushes output up, the central bank should immediately raise interest rates enough to bring output right back to potential rallies.
Why is that optimal?
Because a demand shock pushes both output and inflation in the same direction. By stabilizing the output gap, the central bank simultaneously stabilizes current inflation, through the lambda XD term, and anchors future inflation expectations, plus one achieving both its goals. No trade-off there.
But what about a supply shock, like that oil price example, the $2 term?
Ugh, that's much trickier. A negative supply shock. Higher oil prices pushes inflation up, but simultaneously pushes output down, increases the negative output gap.
So the central bank faces a direct trade-off. Stabilize inflation means making the recession worse. Cushion the recession means letting inflation rise further.
Exactly. Optimal policy here requires the central bank to accommodate the shock to some degree. Trying to fight the inflation all the way back to zero immediately would require slamming the brakes so hard it causes a potentially massive recession. The best response is usually to accept some temporary rise in inflation to cushion the output blow. Find the least painful balance.
This idea of how the central bank should react, especially to inflation expectations, leads us to the Taylor principle, right?
Yes, a really crucial guideline for setting the policy interest rate. It's named after John Taylor, who observed actual Fed policy.
What does it state?
It states that when expected inflation rises, the central bank must raise its nominal interest rate by more than the increase in expected inflation.
More than one for one. Why is that more than so critical?
Because the whole point of raising rates is to increase the real interest rate, to cool the economy down. Think about it. If expected inflation goes up by 1% and the Fed only raises the nominal rate by 1%, the real rate hasn't changed at all. Policy is passive.
Worse, if they raise it by less than 1%.
The real rate actually falls, which would stimulate the economy further and pour fuel on the inflationary fire. Totally counterproductive. To tighten policy and dampen inflation, the nominal rate hike must exceed the expected inflation hike, ensuring the real rate rises.
So the coefficient on expected inflation in the policy rule has to be greater than one?
Mathematically, yes. That condition is vital. And there's a deeper technical reason, too, related to model stability.
Which is?
If the central bank violates the Taylor principle, if that coefficient is less than one, the whole rational expectations equilibrium can become indeterminate.
Meaning multiple possible outcomes.
Yeah, it means there isn't a unique, stable path for inflation and output. The economy could sort of jump onto self-fulfilling inflationary paths just based on arbitrary shifts in expectations, completely unrelated to economic fundamentals. Adhering to the Taylor principle anchors expectations and ensures a unique, stable equilibrium.
And we have a pretty stark historical example of what happens when this principle is violated, don't we? The great inflation in the U.S.
Absolutely. The textbook case. Roughly 1965 to 1979, the pre-Volcker Fed. Numerous studies suggest that, quite often, the Fed's nominal interest rate adjustments failed to keep pace with rising inflation expectations.
So inflation would tick up, they'd raise rates, but not enough.
Not aggressively enough.
Right.
The real interest rate often fell or stayed too low, effectively accommodating the inflation rather than fighting it. This systematic failure to raise real rates sufficiently is widely seen as a key reason why inflation became so high and persistent during that era. It took Volcker's aggressive policy, which definitely obeyed the Taylor principle, to finally break that cycle.
Okay, so stickiness creates the short-run effect. The NKPC models how forward-looking agents behave within that sticky environment. But one puzzle remains. Why do the effects of monetary policy seem to last for quite a while, quarters, even years, if people are rational and forward-looking? Why isn't the adjustment faster?
Good question. The key mechanism for persistence is, again, rooted in the structure of the stickiness itself. It's not just that prices are sticky, it's that they are often set in staggered multi-period contracts.
Back to the staggered contracts idea, like Taylor's wage models.
Exactly. Think about Taylor's original models of staggered wage setting. Imagine, say, half the labor force signs two-year contracts in January, the other half signs two-year contracts in July.
So at any point in time, half the workforce is locked into a wage decided maybe a year ago.
Right. Now, suppose the central bank announces today a new, perfectly credible plan to lower inflation over the next 2 years. Even though the policy is fully anticipated, the workers whose contracts aren't up for renegotiation today simply cannot adjust their wages immediately.
Their wages are fixed based on old information and expectations.
Precisely. This inherent staggering means that even perfectly anticipated, systematic monetary policy changes will have real effects that unfold gradually over time as successive cohorts of contracts expire and get renegotiated under the new policy reality.
This is a really important point. It means policy can work and have lasting effects, even if it's not a surprise. Unlike in pure new classical models where only surprises mattered.
Exactly. The staggering itself provides the inertia. It ensures the economy adjusts smoothly, or perhaps sluggishly, rather than instantly. The effects persist because the adjustment process is spread out over the duration of the longest contracts.
And connecting this persistence back to the forward-looking NKPC, the credibility of the central bank's future plans becomes even more critical.
Hugely critical. Yeah. Think about a central bank wanting to disinflate, bring inflation down. In the NKPC, current inflation depends on expected future inflation. If the central bank can make a truly credible commitment today to keep inflation low in the future, that will directly lower at peak plus $1 today.
And lower expected future inflation makes it easier to lower actual current inflation, according to the NKPC equation.
Yes. It shifts the short-run trade-off. If people setting prices today believe the central bank will be tough on inflation tomorrow, they will moderate their own price increases today. This means the central bank can achieve its disinflation target with a smaller, less painful recession, a lower sacrifice ratio.
So credibility about the future directly impacts the cost of policy actions today.
Absolutely. Commitment isn't just about the long run. It shapes the short-run dynamics profoundly in these forward-looking models.
This leads us directly into the final big policy debate. Should central banks operate under fixed rules, or should they maintain discretion to react flexibly to events? The Barrow-Gordon framework is central here.
It is. The Barrow-Gordon model really crystallizes the problem. It assumes a rational, well-meaning central bank that wants to stabilize both inflation and output. But, and this is the crucial assumption, it lacks the ability to credibly commit to its future actions.
It can't tie its own hands. Why is that a problem?
Because of the time inconsistency problem. Let's think about the central bank's objectives, often represented by a loss function like Lord Alry equals 2 plus lambda, Pufflanco.
Minimize squared deviations of inflation from zero and squared deviations of the output gap from some target level, $2.
And the key is that society, or the policymaker, often has an output target tolerance that is above the economy's natural rate of output, which we can normalize to $6,000. Maybe because of taxes or unemployment benefits or other distortions, the natural rate is seen as inefficiently low.
So there's always this underlying desire to push output a bit higher.
Exactly. Now, combine that desire with the short-run Phillips curve trade-off. The central bank knows that if it could generate surprise inflation, it could temporarily push output $6 closer to its desired target dollars.
The temptation to exploit the short-run stickiness for a temporary output gain.
That's the temptation. But here's the catch. We're assuming rational expectations. The public knows the central bank has this objective function and understands the Phillips curve. They anticipate the central bank's temptation to create surprise inflation.
So they build that anticipated inflation into their wage and price setting from the start.
Precisely. Under discretion, where the central bank just optimizes period by period without commitment, systematic surprise inflation becomes impossible in equilibrium. Everyone expects the central bank to inflate, so it does, but it doesn't get the output boost because the inflation was anticipated.
What's the end result, the equilibrium under discretion?
It's a really inefficient outcome. You get excessive inflation, what's called the inflationary bias, but output remains stuck at the natural rate, $16, or unemployment at up in dollars. The central bank causes inflation purely because of its inability to commit not to try and boost output, even though that attempt is futile in equilibrium.
And the actual level of this inflationary bias depends on how much the central bank cares about output and how tempting that output target is.
Exactly. The formula is often shown as PIDISC, FRECK lambda, where alpha captures the slope of the short-run Phillips curve. More weight on output or a higher output target leads to more inflation bias.
And technically, the optimal policy response under discretion follows a specific type of rule.
Yes, it tends to be a level rule. The central bank adjusts the level of its policy instrument based on the current level of inflation or expected inflation. It's always just reacting to the current situation without being bound by past promises or failures.
Okay, so discretion leads to inflation bias. How does commitment, operating under a rule, fix this?
A credible commitment mechanism, a binding rule that constrains future policy, fundamentally changes the game. By committing, say, to a zero inflation target and sticking to it no matter the temptation to boost output, the central bank convinces the public it won't try to create surprise inflation.
If the public believes the commitment,
they set their inflation expectations to the target level, say, zero. With expected inflation anchored at zero, the central bank has no incentive to actually inflate, because doing so would only push inflation away from the target without any output gain. The equilibrium shifts to the efficient outcome. Zero inflation, and output at the natural rate. The inflationary bias disappears.
And the type of rule needed for optimal commitment is different?
Yes, it's typically a difference rule. This means the central bank adjusts the change in its policy instrument based on deviations from target. A difference rule implicitly carries memory if inflation was too high last period. The rule forces a stronger contraction this period to get back on track. This history dependence makes the commitment more credible, because reneging today has consequences for required actions tomorrow.
But in the real world, truly binding, ironclad rules are hard. What if there's a huge unexpected shock? This leads to institutional solutions, like Rogoff's idea.
Exactly. Kenneth Rogoff pointed out that perfect commitment is often unrealistic. So instead, we can use institutional design. If the problem is the central bank's temptation to inflate, why not appoint someone to run the central bank who is less tempted? Appoint a conservative central banker.
Someone who hates inflation more than the average person.
Precisely. Formally, you appoint a central banker whose loss function puts a higher relative weight on inflation stabilization, a higher alpha, compared to society's preferences. You pick an inflation hawk.
How does that help?
Because this conservative central banker has less incentive to trade off inflation for output, they will naturally choose a lower inflation rate, even under discretion. Rational agents understand the central banker's preferences and lower their inflation expectations accordingly. It reduces or even eliminates the inflationary bias without needing a formal binding rule. This is a major argument for central bank independence insulate policymakers from political pressure to boost output.
But there's no free lunch, right? What's the potential downside of having an overly inflation-averse central banker?
The trade-off is potentially higher output volatility. Think about that adverse supply shock again, like the oil price spike. Society might prefer to tolerate a bit more inflation to cushion the recession, but the super conservative central banker, caring almost only about inflation, might slam on the brakes much harder, fighting the inflation aggressively, even if it means a deeper, more painful recession.
So less inflation bias, but possibly bigger swings in output and employment.
That's the potential cost. There's an optimal degree of conservatism. You want someone more conservative than society, but perhaps not too much more conservative. It's about balancing credibility against stabilization flexibility.
Okay, that brings us nicely to the end. We've covered a huge amount of ground on Keynesian models with nominal rigidities. Let's try to boil down the absolute must-know points for someone prepping for that exam.
Point one, monetary policy gets its short-run power only because prices and wages are sticky, nominal rigidities. That stickiness allows the central bank's control over nominal rates to influence real rates.
Point two, this power is temporary. In the long run, money is neutral. Prices adjust fully and real outcomes depend on real factors. The Phillips curve is vertical.
Point three, modern New Keynesian models and KPC emphasize forward-looking expectations. Current inflation depends on expected future inflation and the output gap. This makes managing expectations paramount.
Point four, the Taylor principle is crucial. To stabilize inflation, nominal interest rates must rise more than one for one with expected inflation to ensure the real rate increases. Violating it is destabilizing.
Point five. Staggered contracts explain why policy effects can be persistent, even with rational expectations. Adjustments ripple through the economy over time.
And finally, point six, the rules versus discretion debate. Discretion without commitment leads to an inflationary bias due to time inconsistency. Commitment, via rules or institutions like appointing a conservative central banker, can eliminate this bias, but might involve trade-offs like potentially higher output volatility.
Nail those points, understand the intuition behind the NKPC and the commitment problem, and you're in very good shape. The core tension is always between short-run stickiness allowing policy effects and long-run neutrality driven by rational expectations and price adjustment.
Okay, so let's leave our listeners with a final thought, something to chew on, building on that rules versus discretion tension. We discussed Rogoff's solution. Appoint an independent, inflation-averse central banker. It reduces inflation bias, but might make recessions worse after supply shocks.
Right, the potential stability trade-off.
So here's the question for you, the listener. If you were advising a government setting up its monetary framework from scratch, which path would you lean towards? Would you trust an institutionally designed person, the independent, conservative central banker, accepting their potentially overly harsh reactions to some shocks? Or would you try to implement a strict pre-announced interest rate rule, knowing that such rules can be hard to define perfectly and might lack the political legitimacy to survive a really severe unforeseen crisis?
Which is more robust in the face of true uncertainty, human judgment is constrained by preferences, or a rigid institutional rule? There's no easy answer.
Something to ponder. Understand that pension, and you really understand the core challenges of modern monetary policy. Good luck with the exams.
Indeed. Good luck.
Until the next deep dive. Keep learning.